Your Bibles, please turn to Revelation chapter 12. And while you are turning there, just a couple of things I should have mentioned, but please pray for our teams from First Baptist School. We've got our basketball teams, boys and girls, that are down at Pensacola Christian College and playing in a tournament over the next couple of days. And I know they would appreciate your prayers, and we'll maybe even try and give you some more information if you want to check. Maybe on Facebook, we'll be able to maybe even update you here on some of the details concerning when they're going to be playing. Also, on Sunday, because we do have the morning special Christmas program, there will not be children's church this next Sunday. So just want to remind you about that, parents with their children. Revelation chapter 12, we've been going through the book of Revelation now, and we've been taking some time especially to understand some things. And I've taught through the book of Revelation many, many times, but I've really tried to make sure that we delve in and we get some things correct in our understanding, especially as we go through it here this time. Revelation chapter 12, and beginning in verse number 1, says this, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born." Now, what is Revelation 12 about? I think it's important that we get this right. You know, after all, the Bible tells us that we need to rightly divide the word of truth. You know, it reminds me of the story told about a young man who was speaking to the pulpit committee of a church. They were considering this young man to be their pastor. And so the pulpit committee had met with him to interview him, and one of the deacons asked, said, "Well, listen, do you know the Bible? Do you know well?" And he said, "Yes." And so that man representing the pulpit committee said, "Well, you know, since you know the Bible fairly well, then I'm sure you're familiar with the story of the prodigal son. Would you tell us the story of the prodigal son?" Well, a big old smile came across the face of this young preacher, and he said, "Yes, I'd be happy to tell you the story." And here's what he said. He said the story. "There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus who went down to Jericho by night, and he fell upon stony ground, and the thorns choked him half to death. The next morning, Solomon and his wife Gomorrah came by and carried him down to the ark for Moses to take care of. But as he was going through the eastern gate into the ark, he caught his hair in a limb, and he hung there 40 days and 40 nights. And he afterwards did hunger, and the ravens then came and fed him. The next day, the 3 wise men came and carried him down to the boat dock, and he caught a ship to Nineveh. And when he got there, he found Delilah sitting on the wall, and he said, 'Chunk her down, boys, chunk her down.' And they said, 'How many times shall we chunk her down? Till 7 times 7? And he said, 'Nay, but 70 times 7. And they chunked her down 490 times, and she burst asunder in their midst. And they picked up 12 baskets of leftovers. And now, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be?'" Well, surprisingly, the man that was leading the pulpit committee said, "Listen, I've heard enough. I say let's go ahead and vote on him. After all, I've never heard anybody teach the Bible like this young man." Now, if you didn't realize, that was filled with all sorts of problems, wasn't it? But you know, we can laugh about obvious misinterpretations. But I can tell you here tonight, especially when we get to a chapter like Revelation chapter 12, that it likewise is suspiciously, even suspect with oftentimes false interpretations. Such as, let me share a couple with you. For instance, this one here, astronomical signs. You know, there are those who will take Revelation chapter 12. In fact, I have to tell you, this actually happened 4 years ago. This particular passage was touted as being fulfilled before our very eyes. You see, it was 4 years ago that there was a strange alignment that was happening in the sky, in which case there were two constellations, the constellation Virgo, standing for the Virgin, and the constellation Leo, Leo the Lion, and a couple of other planets, including Jupiter, also the Sun and the Moon. Everything seemed to line up together, and there were actually nine stars plus three planets. That made 12. And by the way, this also happened on the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. And so somebody said, wow, this must be the sign that Jesus is coming back again. Now, by the way, this may not be a good picture, this next one here, but just you can see what they're imagining as we even look at it, a picture of these signs in the sky. If we can have that next picture put up, please. And it's really showing here the constellation Virgo imagined in the sky, almost as if she is conceiving again, and almost as if a virgin is conceiving, but this time Leo the Lion. And if you count, there's actually 12 bodies out there in the sky. Somebody said, wow, this has to be, it has to be. And by the way, it sounded right to some. There's only one problem. As I said, that was 4 years ago. Did Jesus come back again 4 years ago? Did any of you miss it? Did any of you notice when Jesus? No, it didn't happen. By the way, it is for that reason that oftentimes unbelievers, they laugh at us. And they laugh at us even making these false predictions and these false things. And listen, it doesn't matter if, you know, it's the blood moons or it's the constellations that seem to be lining up with planets. It's not what this passage is teaching. Now, how about this other interpretation, the Catholic one? You see, the Catholic Church has taught that this is the Virgin Mary woman. After all, it's a woman in this particular chapter. And so they jump to the conclusion and say it has to be the Virgin Mary. Now, there's several reasons why that also cannot be true, several things that do not fit. For instance, Mary gave birth on earth. This woman is in heaven. Verse number 6 says, this woman fled into the wilderness, was sustained for 3.5 years. There's nothing in the story of Mary that would somehow line up with that. Verse number 13 says, the dragon persecuted the woman. That didn't happen. And likewise, verse 14 says, the woman flew into the wilderness on two wings of a great eagle. That there's nothing in this fits with Mary. And yet sometimes they try and squeeze and they try and force this interpretation upon others. In addition, I can tell you that this is not the church. In addition, it is not Mary Baker Patterson Gloveretti. You say, Mary who? Well, there's this woman who started what was called the Christian Science Church. And the Christian Science Church that basically says that sickness is not real, it's just simply imagined. This woman, Mary Baker Glover Eddy, she said that she was in the Bible, Revelation 12, the woman, she said, is me. No, she's not. Well, what is Revelation 12 all about? Revelation 12 is a parenthetical chapter. That means that, again, it's giving us some background information. It's a pause. It's giving us some necessary things to understand from a more full standpoint. Basically, Revelation 12 is about God's purpose for Israel, especially during the tribulation, not some aligning of planets, not the Virgin Mary, not the church, not Mary Baker Eddy. It's none of those things. And in fact, it's interesting when you get to the end of chapter 11, we found the ark, but notice the ark of the testament is in heaven. Why is that important? Basically, that ark is a testament to a promise God made with Israel. Through Abraham, through his descendants, that promise is still binding. It's the ark of his testament. It's still relevant. These chapters are parenthetical. What are we going to notice in chapter 12? Basically, these things in relationship to Israel. First of all, we're going to talk about the woman, then the dragon, then the child, the angel, the voice, and the persecution. First of all, let's notice the woman. The woman represents Israel. In verse number 1, it says, and there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. Now, John looks on, he sees what he says here is a great wonder. Technically, there are going to be seven wonders or signs that are going to be prominent. This is actually the first one. It's a symbol. It's a symbol. The woman is Israel. And notice she has children. Notice she has 12 stars. That 12 would now include all 12 of the sons of Israel. And there's, again, many views, but this is the nation of Israel. Obviously, this woman is symbolic of Israel that is important to God and important for our discussion of the end times. We see, by the way, oftentimes in the Bible, in the Old Testament, Israel is pictured as a woman. For instance, in Jeremiah 3, verse number 20, "Surely as a wife treacherously departeth from her husband, so have ye dealt treacherously with me, O house of Israel, saith the Lord." That you'll all be familiar with the book of Hosea that we're going to be discussing here shortly. The book of Hosea is a picture as Hosea loves his wife, even so God loves rebellious and unfaithful Israel. It's pictured with a woman. The description in verse number one, notice she's clothed with the sun, but also the moon is under her feet. That's interesting. It's interesting for several reasons, but notice the moon under feet. One of the things that I found interesting is that the moon is not only just simply, it's not something that they worship like the pagans would worship, but the moon helps them keep time. In Israel, their calendar is a lunar calendar. That means that they determine the days of the month by the cycle of the moon. And so therefore, the moon under her feet is again tying in with Israel. We see also this woman as being expecting and the pains of giving birth, just like as a woman gives a birth through a painful process. So Israel gave birth to Jesus Christ. That's another reason, by the way, that it's not the Virgin Mary, but Israel is the one who literally produces the Christ child. And so the Messiah, we notice that first of all, the woman represents Israel. Secondly, how about the dragon? The dragon represents Satan. In verse number 3, it says, "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon." Probably from this description is the closest that we get to the caricatures, the descriptions, sometimes the comic-like characters that we imagine the devil with horns and a red suit and a pitchfork. Well, here he is called a great red dragon. Notice having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and it cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Now, we notice here, first of all, that he's described as a great red dragon. Understand that this is a sign. Satan is not actually a dragon, but if you'll also, by the way, imagine here, because they are connected, dragon and serpent. What exactly is a dragon? Now, I know that, you know, if you were to go to Disney and watch, you know, some of the Disney films like Pete's Dragon or, you know, How to Train Your Dragon, you know, those have cute dragons. But in mythology, dragons, that they were basically serpents with feet. Did you know, if you go back prior to the fall, that that's exactly how serpents were described? It's only after the fall and the curse that God turned to the serpent and said, from now on, you are going to crawl upon your belly. You'll no longer, in other words, before that, the serpent probably had feet, dragon-like, looked like a dragon prior to the fall. I don't think that's by accident here. Notice in verse number 3 and in verse number 9, he's referred to as the great red dragon, but also notice that old serpent, he's described as great, not the greatest, but great. He has power. He has more power than us, but not more power than the Almighty God. Not more power than Jesus. Notice also he is described as red. It was interesting when I looked up that word, that the word for red is a specific shade. It's in the Greek, the word is pyrus. We get many words from that. One of the words that we get is pyromaniac or pyrophobia. Fear or somebody who deals with fire, a Pyromaniac is somebody who is mad and crazy and likes to see things burn. Basically, this is describing a fire red, which is appropriate because the old devil, he's eventually going to end up in the lake of fire. He is fire red. He is a red, great red dragon. But we also notice in verse number 4 that Satan, this dragon, is seeking to attack both the woman and the child she is about to bear. He is trying to destroy, in other words, Israel, on both sides, and that's why he attacks sometimes the woman. But as soon as the woman gives birth to the child, notice immediately he is ready to devour. We also notice about Satan, about the dragon, that he has 7 heads. Now, there's many thoughts about this, but I happen to believe that the 7 heads represent the 7 empires. As world empires, as Daniel, this ties in with Daniel. Daniel had seen it in advance. He had seen that there are going to be 7 world empires, and the 7th one is the one ruled by the Antichrist. The 7 heads would include Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the 7th being the one of the Antichrist. Notice that paramount to this is the purpose of the final one: to destroy Christ, to destroy Israel. And John goes on in verse number 4 to describe, again, this is all parenthetical. It gives us background information that is important for us to understand. For instance, in verse number 4, he describes the tail of this great red dragon, that he sweeps with him 1/3 of the stars of heaven. Now, in this case here, stars is not referring to celestial beings like we might think in outer space. But stars are sometimes a reference to angels. And it is thought in this verse that this would even explain, where does Satan get his allies? Where does he get demons? The demons come. They were angels. They were fallen angels. And basically describing that Satan, when Satan fell, that he took with him probably, we think, 1/3 of the angels. Now, we don't know how many that is. You know, the Bible even describes elsewhere that the number of angels in total is innumerable, but 1/3 of them, they fell with Satan. Now, by the way, the history of Israel also is important, because as we look at these empires, we have to understand that many times nations have been used to oppose Israel. For instance, Egypt. We see Egypt on this map. A Pharaoh was the king of Egypt, and he tried to stop. He even tried to destroy Israel, remember, at the Red Sea. And we know that when they finally left, and after they crossed the Red Sea, the first nation that, of course, fought them was the Amalekites. We know of other nations as well that were used to fight. And we know that many times they tried to even do in the Israelites. They tried to destroy them. They tried to annihilate them. We've got the famous story, for instance, in the book of Esther, where there's one man by the name of Haman that tries to rid the world of the Jews. He failed, of course. We know, of course, about Antiochus Epiphanes and the Syrians. They failed. The Romans failed. Muslim persecution came. European persecution. Persecution by the Roman Catholic Church. Little is known about this, but the Roman Catholic Church, not only were they crusading against the Muslims, but they also were oftentimes crusading against the Jews. Many Jews were also killed during the Crusades. Of course, we know about Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust. Now, why am I mentioning all of these? I'm mentioning every time somebody has tried to annihilate the Jews, they've failed. How's that? Because God has decreed, I've got a plan for them. I've got a plan. He said it. He stated it back in the beginning. He said to Abraham that I'm going to bless him that blesseth thee, curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. And if God has promised it, even Satan can't stop God and his plan. Now, by the way, we look at Satan and his activities, and really there have been 2 simultaneous purposes Satan has had from the beginning. First of all, is an ambition to be worshipped. Satan wants worship. He wants to steal worship from God. But secondly, if he can't be worshipped, he wants to destroy the one whom God has chosen to be worshipped, because he is the rightful Savior, Jesus Christ. And the woman that produced him, he wants to destroy that woman. Now, we notice the woman is Israel. We notice the dragon is Satan. Again, this is a parenthetical look at Israel. But we notice third, the child. The child is Jesus. Is Jesus. Notice in verse number 5, and she brought forth a man child, who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now, despite Satan's best efforts, the woman succeeds in bearing Jesus. She gives birth to this male child, the one whom Israel, even Isaiah prophesied. We looked at even on Sunday, Isaiah 9:6, for unto us a child is born. The incarnation happened. That's why we celebrate Christmas. Jesus came. He was born. He fulfilled all the Old Testament prophecies. Satan could not stop Christ from coming. And by the way, it's interesting how this is phrased. It's phrased sort of in an awkward way for us, but not awkward to God. It mentions that he's born, and then it says, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. In other words, it seems to me it doesn't make sense at first glance, but I'll tell you, in the mind of God, the first and second coming, they are tied together. You and I, we look at things in the past, we look at things in the future, God looks at things as eternal. And so therefore, God's plan has always been settled. The outcome is not for debate. Therefore, he ties the first coming and Jesus even ascending back and then getting ready to return again. It's all together. Now, we notice that Satan tries to defeat the woman. But verse number 6 is interesting. It gives us a glimpse. Now we are talking about the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. For the Jews, it's very important because it says, and the woman, that is Israel, fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God that they should feed her, for there 1,260 days. This should not surprise us. Jesus himself, when he was on the earth, he predicted in the Olivet Discourse that there be a day that the Jew would have to flee Judea, would have to run, would have to flee into the mountains, would have to flee and pray that it not be on the Sabbath and pray, you know, that you not be with child. He said there's going to be then great tribulation for such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be, Matthew 24:21. Now, he indicates here that the Jews have to flee. They have to flee to a place in the wilderness. There they are protected and provisioned by God. This lasts for 3.5 years. We think the latter, the last 3.5 years. Now, we don't know a whole lot, but this also was actually prepared for us in other stories to a certain extent, not entirely 3.5 years, but we know when Jesus was born, they had to flee to Egypt. They had to go because Herod was trying to destroy all of the baby boys. We know as well that when the Jews, the destruction of Jerusalem came in 70 AD, that many of the Jews, they likewise had to flee and flee into the wilderness. There are those who teach that these predictions, the prophecies here in Revelation 12, have already been fulfilled, but I don't think so. I think that it is still in the future. Now, where do the Jews flee? There's actually two possibilities that have been offered. One is a general and the other one is a more specific. First of all, letter A, let me give you this one here. This is one I happen to believe in, that the Jews will flee to a safe country. And where's that safe country? It is to the east. It's always described fleeing to the east. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, there were groups of Jews that fled to Edom and Moab during the Babylonian invasion of Judah in the 6th century. Likewise, when the Romans came in 70 AD, some of the Jews, they fled again to the east. And so we know that during that time that there were some Jews that even holed themselves up in the mountain called Masada. We think about David. David even pictured this. When David had to flee Absalom, where did he flee? He fled and he crossed the Jordan River just to the east at a little place called Mahanaim. Now, one more specific possibility has been offered that I want to talk about, and that is those who would say, this is obviously talking about the place called Petra. The Jews fleeing to Petra, the Red Rock City, is a thought Many believe that when they flee into the wilderness, that that is to the rock Red City. Petra is an attraction, basically, today. I know there's some people that live around it, but it's really not set up here for a large number of people now to live and survive. And besides, if it was, it would be an easy target, I think. And yet, we know that this was a place that was very prominent. There are many who believe that the place of Petra in Jordan today, that it was the place where Moses struck the rock, disobeying God's command to speak to the rock. It was the place where Moses, after that, was told, you can go up into the mountain and you can overlook and you can see the promised land, but you cannot enter in. It is thought that at Petra, this is the place where Miriam and Aaron may have died and been buried nearby. It is also a place that in the days of Jesus Christ was a thriving, busy city. And so naturally, a lot of people believe that Petra might be the place. I was even told this, that at one time there were cults, or there were even Bible believers, evangelical groups, that actually thought that this was so surely the place that they actually hid Bibles in the caves and in the buildings. Now, it's interesting, one thing, and a few of us, we've been to Petra. One time I took a group and we actually journeyed into Petra. But it's interesting, a picture with the geography, because in order to get into Petra, you have to go down this winding, narrow trail that finally empties out through a place called the Seek. The Seek is literally a narrow passageway. If you want to even say it this way, it is a cleft in the rock, just a cleaving of the rock, a place where you have to just narrowly exit into this city. Why is that important? Many would see the analogy of what Jesus said. He said, straight is the gate and narrows the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it, Matthew 7:14. Now, I wouldn't be dogmatic about this. I'm not saying Petra isn't. I just don't see it. I don't see that it's large enough. I also think it would be too easy here to attack. But I do believe that it offers to us here just simply some possibilities to imagine in our minds. I do believe that during the tribulation, Israel will be forced to leave the land. Why? Because they're going to have to get to the place where they then, similar to the Red Sea, where they have their back against the wall, where they have no way for them with their, you know, right now, you know, we even think, you know, in years past, we've thought about, you know, great militaries and armies and nations that have been so strong and superpowers. And even though the nation of Israel has been small, yet they have been just dominant in wars against their foes. You think about the Six-Day War. You think about the Yom Kippur War. You think about all of the skirmishes that they've had. And yet I'm here to tell you, I happen to believe, according to this, this is indicating here, they're going to have one time that they have to flee before they turn and they find their one true hope is not their military. It's not their might. It's not their cleverness. It's not the Iron Dome. It's not their defenses. It's not the Israeli Air Force. It's not, you know, all of the things that they have invented. It's not all of their geniuses. It's not the Nobel Prizes. But their answer, their solution, their salvation is through Jesus Christ. And it's not until they get to the point where they've exhausted everything else in the tribulation that the woman, finally, this child, is now rightfully received as king. Rightfully received by a nation that up until now has been just sort of dealing, you know, with all sorts of things. And I happen to believe, by the way, from a condition standpoint, that you can certainly see that in the nation of Israel today, that there's a climate that is anticipating here something is going to come. And so it makes me very excited to think about the fact that God has a plan for Israel, and God's plan is unstoppable. You cannot stop God from using Israel. And we're going to stop there here tonight. We'll pick it up next week. Now, I want to continue here in Revelation chapter 12, but I want to give you some of those thoughts. And again, let's not get deterred here. The woman is Israel. The child is Jesus, the dragon is Satan. And this is all to just simply give us some background information important for us to understand what God is doing and what God will do. God uses Israel.